The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Where does the phrase a serpent's tooth come from?
The phrase a serpent's tooth is actually from Act 1, Scene 4 of King Lear. And it's Lear's remarks to Cordelia when she won't perform the way that he wants her to perform in showing her affections towards her king, liege, and father. And one of the remarks that he makes is that how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have an unthankful child. And that's kind of what the book is about to a certain extent. It's about, you know, what are perceived as being unthankful children.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Wyoming author Craig Johnson about his ninth Walt Longmire crime novel, A Serpent's Tooth, and the TV show based on the series. This is the ninth book in your Walt Longmire mystery series, but there are probably a lot of people who haven't even read one. So let's talk about who Walt Longmire is.
Walt's, I guess Walt is what I tend to refer to as over. He's one of those guys that he's overage. He's a little overweight. He's a little overly depressed. But, you know, he still gets up in the morning and gets the job done. And, you know, to me, that's kind of a heroic character, certainly more heroic than the usual stuff that you see in crime fiction, which is the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal. Every woman wants him. Every man fears him. He can kill anyone with a #2 Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds. I mean, I've never met that guy, and I have serious doubts as to whether it is that he really exists. And so Walt's a little bit more of an everyman kind of guy like that. And, you know, he's the sheriff of the least populated county and the least populated state in America, you know, so he doesn't really have all that CSI technology, you know, to fall back on, nor does he have a staff where he can make a radio call and have 13 guys to help him in situations. You know, he's a lot like a lot of, you know, Western rural sheriffs, you know, that they do the best job that they can with the resources that they have. And he's, you know, kind of a little bit the sadder but wiser kind of guy like that. His wife died about 5 years ago. He's still dealing, you know, with the difficulties of that. You know, he's got a kind of an estranged relationship with a daughter who's a lawyer in Philadelphia, and you know, complications in his life like that I think, you know, make him, you know, a little bit more realistic than a lot of the stuff that's out there.
He also doesn't even have a cell phone.
No, he doesn't have one. But, you know, here in Montana, as it is in Wyoming, 9 times out of 10, it doesn't do you any good to have one anyway, because it doesn't work. So it was just one of those things where, you know, I live in U-Cross, you know, Wyoming, which has a population of 25, and it's at the base of the Bighorn Mountains going out into the Powder River country. And, you know, it's one of those, you know, very rural areas like that. And, you know, and if I ever catch that little guy walking around, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? I'm going to give him an earful, I can tell you that much. But I don't know. For Walt, you know, it's one of those things where there was a reason why it was that I made the character a sheriff like that. It was kind of essential that you know, not only was it that iconoclastic version of you know, Western law enforcement, but it's also, most people don't know that it's actually one of the only elected law enforcement officials in the United States. So not only do you have to be a policeman, but you have to be a politician also, or else, you know, you're out selling used cars, you know, in 4 years. And what it does also, though, is it kind of connects Walt to his community. He's very, very connected, you know, to the society, the community, whose laws in which it is that he enforces. And that's kind of another thing that I really wanted with that character. I wanted him involved in that society. I didn't want him to be one of those lone wolf, you know, kind of characters that, you know, wanders into town and kills 37 people and solves the problem, you know, and then disappears in the wind. You know, I really wanted him to be, you know, part of that community and dealing with those problems, like in a more realistic manner.
Realistic is good. You know, when we do see that 6'2" man of steel on the TV, I think it just perpetuates all kinds of misconceptions in our culture.
It's not only the characters, but it's also the technology. I one time asked, you know, we have one crime lab in the whole state of Wyoming. It's down in Cheyenne. And I one time asked one of the DCI investigators, I said, you know, how long does it take you guys to get DNA evidence? And he pauses for a second and he says, high-profile case? And I said, yeah. And he goes, about 9 months. And so I said, well, it's not really very realistic what they're doing on television then, is it? And he goes, no, it's really not. He said, somebody gets their gas siphoned at Walmart and they want me to show up with a fingerprint kit, you know. And so it's not a very realistic situation as far as that's concerned. So, but what that did was, you know, having Walt be a sheriff and having him deal more with the social implications, you know, of the job and knowing the people in the county and all of that, it kind of made me focus in the books more on the characters, more on the place, you know, more on the relationships, you know. And, you know, I'm as interested in technology as the next guy like that, but I get kind of bored whenever somebody describes a rifle for 4 pages. That just gets a little bit tiresome for me.
Yeah. Well, the series has been made into a TV show, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But first, there's a passage I'd like you to read that really illustrates what kind of a guy Walt is. It's a great example of his no-nonsense personality.
The man in the back of the brand new King Ranch one-ton diesel was testing its rear suspension. He must have tipped the scales at an easy 400 pounds. He was comfortably seated in what must have been a custom-built Lazy Boy throne, complete with his sheepskin slippers prominently displayed on the foot extension. He wore an oversized, expensive-looking bathrobe draped over a snap-button shirt, with a large turquoise bolo tie and a pair of TCU purple sweatpants. On his head was an honest-to-God sombrero. The harvest is past and the summer is ended, and we are not saved. Vic and Eleanor joined me on the edge of the wooden walkway, an advantage that made us the same height as Roy Lanier. Jeremiah, chapter 8, verse 20. He turned his head and looked at me. You know the word of God, Sheriff? I know entire sentences. He continued to study me, unsure if I was the real deal or if I'd only stumbled upon a line of scripture. The gesture towards one of his massive legs. Inconvenient gout. I apologize for having you come out here and into the night like this, but my joints are hurting so bad I'm afraid that I wouldn't be able to make it up those steps. I watched as John Deere in the ball cap stayed on the other side of the truck bed with a shotgun in his hands. The massive man in the chair settled his eyes on me. I suppose I should introduce myself. I'm Roy Lanier. My undersheriff, Victoria Moretti, was quick to respond. We've heard a lot about you lately. He studied my deputy, and I was pretty sure that he was both attracted and annoyed. Have you now? He glanced at the sullen one behind him and the caballero who had propped an ornately inlaid, pointy-toed boot on the rear bumper of the chariot near the Texas plate. From these two? To my surprise, the Hispanic fellow spoke freely. You are the company you keep. The giant man laughed until he wheezed. Tomas Bidarte here is one of the great vaquero poets. He's in all the anthologies, aren't you, Tom? He tipped his hat. There's no accounting for tastes. Lanier issued a command. Give us one, Tom. Bidarte slipped an elongated knife from the back pocket of his jeans and pushed a button, the stiletto blade leaping out and into the running lights a good 8 inches. He cleaned his fingernails as he spoke. Have more than you show. Talk less than you know. Lend less than you owe. Ride more than you go. The older man shook his head and kicked a slipper at the poet. That wasn't one of your best. Well, Patron, you get what you pay for. Lanier gestured quickly and nodded at the man behind him. One of my dim-witted sons, George. He hunched himself a little forward and looked past me. Excuse me, Sheriff. Mrs. Tisdale. She took a step forward and crossed her arms. That's me. We haven't met formally, but I understand that there is an altercation about the exact location of some fence. She glanced at George, the one who had been dismissed. My men said that they were restringing barbed wire near Frenchy Basin when a group of yours came up and threatened them. We all stood there listening to the crickets rubbing their legs together as Eleanor's words hung in the crisp night. I was having one of those this-could-be-happening-100-years-ago moments when Lanier turned his shoulders and glanced at his son. That won't happen again. He returned his gaze on all of us. That, I can promise you. I looked back at him, his eyes sunk into the fat of his face. You travel well armed. Oh, he reached up and shifted back the brim of his enormous hat. As you can see, we've spent a lot of time down on the border, Hudspeth County to be exact. Do you know that area of Texas, Sheriff? Not particularly. Well, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. He shook his head. It's a war zone down there on the border, godforsaken country, and we've just gotten to the habit of being prepared. He pointed at my sidearm. As you are. I put a hand on one of the building's support poles and thumbed the grain of the wood. There's a difference between prepared and provoking, Mr. Lanier. He smiled. Are we provoking you, Sheriff? It sounds like your men might have been provoking Mrs. Tisdale's men, and I'd just as soon not have a range war on the southern part of my county. His eyes remained immobile as he continued to smile, and it wasn't an attractive expression on his wide face. Your county. Till the next general election, the people of this county have elected me to uphold the laws that they deem fit to enforce. What about the laws of God, Sheriff? Not particularly my jurisdiction, Mr. Lanier. He actually chuckled. Oh, that's all part of our jurisdiction. Besides that fact, I happen to own a portion of your county, Sheriff, almost 12,000 acres. And as far as I know, this is still a free country. I sighed, suddenly tired of the man and his jingo philosophies. Abide by the laws of the county, state, and federal government, and we won't have any trouble, Mr. Lanier. But if you start anything down here with your neighbors, you're going to see me again. He raised a hand. I'm a God-fearing man in search of peaceful solitude in which to raise my family. I want nothing of the world, and the world wants nothing of me. He nodded as if giving a benediction. There is a day of reckoning coming, though, a day when all men must take a side, and the freedoms of some may impinge upon the heresy and godlessness of others. I let George come around the truck before I spoke, specifically to him. You need to register this vehicle in Wyoming.
Walt doesn't waste words.
Well, that was kind of a revelation for me, I have to admit. Like that one of the I guess the head ramrod, like that the producer of the television show Longmire on A&E, like that she asked me a question. Greer Shepherd, like that she was the producer for Nip Tuck and The Closer and a number of other shows. And when very early in the project, one of the things she asked me was, she said, "Well, do you think of Walt as being a verbose kind of character?" And my immediate response was, yes, I absolutely do. I mean, you know, you're in Walt's head for 350, 400 pages, you know, and he's a very very talkative, you know, very astute, you know, kind of character. Like that, she pauses for a second and she goes, "I'm not talking about what he thinks, Craig. I'm talking about what he says." And it was a genuine revelation for me, like that I had to actually admit that, you know, Walt will think, you know, for three or four pages, and then he'll say one sentence is all he does. And in the truest sense of, you know, the Western hero, you know, he doesn't say a great deal like it, but he thinks a great deal.
So you had to learn the difference between script writing and novel writing.
Yeah, you know, they made me an executive creative consultant on the show, like that, and it was an eye opener. I learned an awful lot about a lot of different things, like that. One, they've one of the nice things about it was that it was a package deal from Warner Brothers and A&E, like that. So I actually got to meet the producers, the directors, the writers, and everybody that was involved with the show before I signed on the dotted line. You know, you hear a lot of authors say, you know, my work's been, you know, optioned by Hollywood, and that really doesn't mean much unless, you know, there's something to back it up. And what was nice was Warner Brothers actually put this group of people together and then actually put up the financial abilities to get it made. You know, and like any other business, you know, Hollywood, you know, is victim to, you know, to the monetary aspects of it. I mean, if you get the money, you can get it made. If you don't get the money, you don't. But one of the things I was very impressed with was that the producers and the directors and everything had all read the books. You know, they'd all read the books, you know, to the most, you know, infinite detail, like that. They really understood the characters and the place. And, you know, I'm not Stephen King. I'm not John Grisham. So it's not like I can leverage Hollywood in doing whatever it is that I want them to do. The only insurance that I had really was that they seemed to really love the characters in the place. And so I felt confident that they wouldn't, you know, put Walt on a cruise ship or on a skateboard or, you know, move him to Hawaii or something like that.
We'll be back to talk more about the TV show and the book right after a short break. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Wyoming author Craig Johnson about A Serpent's Tooth, the ninth book in his Walt Longmire crime fiction series. If you tuned in late, no worries. You can listen to the entire program from The Right Questions blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Well, one of the characters in the book, his name is Cord.
Mm-hmm.
He's a 15-year-old boy, and you call him a lost boy.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that means.
Well, just about all of the books I write, I kind of tend to refer to them as socially responsible crime fiction, in the sense that, you know, I'm not just trying to find, you know, clever ways of killing people, you know, or making whodunits. You know, generally I'm trying to make some sort of a statement or another. And, you know, in this one, 9 times out of 10, they tend to be newspaper articles is what they are. And there was actually one of these Warren Jeffs compounds that was actually over in Custer County, South Dakota, you know, right off the border of Wyoming. And they had one of these, you know, polygamy fundamentalist compounds, you know, with gun towers and all of that. And one of the side effects of having that group there was is these 13 and 14-year-old boys were showing up in places like Rapid City, Gillette, Newcastle, like that. And what was happening was is that, you know, the older men that were in these, you know, these polygamy compounds were basically trumping up charges against, you know, the young teenage boys that are coming up just to get rid of them, you know, so that they wouldn't have competition for younger and more wives. And so, you know, here you are with these 13 and 14-year-old boys showing up in these towns. And some of them, you know, they're rather insular, you know, in their upbringing. Like, so they'd never even seen a television or a phone before in their lives. And there they are with no resources, no abilities, you know, trying to find a way to survive. And I just happened to think, you know, well, what if one of these young men, what if one of these lost boys was to turn up, you know, in Walt Longmire's county, how would he deal with it like that? And so it starts out, you know, as a relatively, you know, relatively innocent, you know, social case like that. But then very soon as the investigation begins, we discover that this young man's mother, his advocate, you know, within this group is missing. And nobody seems to be coming forth with any straight answers as to, you know, where she might be or what might have happened to her. And that's kind of when it takes a hard turn into being a criminal case.
There are always references to literature in your books, as we found out from the title. But my friend Flicka appears in this in relationship to this boy in a very funny way. He ends up watching a VHS tape over and over and over again and then trying to go out and catch a horse, which didn't work out very well.
No, it wasn't like my friend Flicka at all. Like, it's this young man has never, he's never seen a television before. He's never seen a movie before like that. And so one of the deputies, when they have the young man there, they don't have anywhere to put him over the weekend. So they put him in one of the holding cells there at the jail like that. And, you know, one of the deputies is there and, you know, the kid is in there reading the Book of Mormon, you know, on his cot. You know, it's almost like, you know, stringing your cup back and forth across the bars and swinging Swing Low Sweet Chariot, you know. And so he looks in there and sees that situation and thinks to himself, you know, good grief, you know, let's get, you know, I'm going to get the kid out. I'm going to make some popcorn and I'll just, you know, downstairs, you know, they've got their training films, you know, for the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department are still on VHS, which kind of gives you an indication of what technological level they're at. But they also have, there was a Methodist church ladies, you know, function that was happening where they were taking all of these old VHS tapes and clothing and all this stuff for a fun drive. And so he finds my friend Flicka with starring Roddy McDowell. And he figures, you know, well, what the heck? That's something the kid could watch. Like that. And so the kid is absolutely mesmerized. He's never seen anything like this before in his life. And, you know, he actually becomes absolutely fixated on the story of my friend Flicka. And so, you know, it kind of becomes a running joke, you know, within the sheriff's department that, you know, well, is he downstairs watching the 905 viewing of my friend Flicka? You know, no, he's down there actually watching the 938 is actually what he's doing. So... But it was kind of fun, you know, to try and, like, you know, show the differences, you know, between those time periods, you know, when My Friend Flicka was written and the kind of things that Walt has to deal with now, in the sense that I kind of look at Walt as being, you know, something of a generations afterward of the Gene Autry and the Roy Rogers kind of cowboys, you know, the white hat guys, you know, that had a code that they lived by and they were good guys. It's just that Walt kind of tends to live in a little bit more complex world these days like that. You know, they you know, Roy Rogers never had to kick down the door of a crack house, you know, or a methamphetamine house or something. Though I do think that would probably have made for some very interesting cowboy songs in all actuality. But, you know, Walt's in a little bit more complex world that he has to deal with. And, you know, to me, that's what makes the books, you know, a little bit more interesting. You know, I mean, I don't think I would have enjoyed writing them as period westerns. You know, I like the contemporary American West. I think it's an absolutely magnificent place. Like, there's a lot of drama going on here, a lot of conflicts and a lot of change. Like, and to me, that's the hotbed, you know, for writing novels.
I want to talk about the TV show shortly, but one of the things I really liked is that you didn't have a bunch of grisly murders You didn't come up with all kinds of creative ways to kill people. I mean, somebody does die, a couple of people die, but there was no really graphic violence.
Right.
Where are you on that?
I'm not a big one for graphic violence. I really just think, you know, that, I mean, 9 times out of 10, you know, I mean, you have to keep in mind that, you know, that my protagonist is a sheriff. Like that. So generally when the sheriff is called in, the death has already happened. You know, that's why it is that they're calling him in like that. And so a lot of times, you know, it's the pre-story like that to what's actually happening. And then for me, like that, you know, as far as any kind of, you know, like, you know, violent acts are concerned, you know, I'm firmly of the belief that a little goes a long way. It doesn't really take much, you know, for your imagination like that to fill in the blanks. And 9 times out of 10, the reader's imagination is infinitely more, you know, loaded, you know, than you know, the words that I can put down. Like it. And so it's just not a really important part to the storyline for me. It's not something that I feel strongly about including. You know, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, you have two very strong physical acts, you know, in these type of books. Generally, it's violence and sex like that. And I tend to take the short road like that whenever I'm dealing with both of those, as a matter of fact. It's just not something that I'm really all that interested in writing about, to be honest.
I think humor is your strong point.
It is. That I have no control over whatsoever. Like, you know, whenever you're kind of trapped, you know, because the books are like, you know, the books are written, you know, in first person, you know, for 350, 400 pages. And an awful lot of the humor that's in the books, you know, tends to be, you know, Walt's perspective on things. I mean, you can see that, you know, when he's looking at Roy Lanier like that, and he's trying to gauge, you know, just exactly who Roy Lanier is, you know, and just how much hot air happens to be coming out of Roy Lanier. And, you know, it's one of those fun things like that, because when I first started writing the books, you know, Walt was not, you know, that smart, and I really didn't enjoy his character. So I went back and I rewrote the book, and I had a little bit of a brainstorm, an epiphany, where I decided, you know what, the people that read these books, they might have read other books too. Like, and so, you know, what I decided was, what I should do, like that, I should make Walt, you know, he's playing football for USC, like that, you know, and he's an English major, for gosh sakes, like that, you know. Of course, Vietnam takes a hand, and he ends up being a Marine investigator in Vietnam, but he's very well read, you know, he's very educated, he's got a good sense of humor. And that makes him good company. You know, that's one of the key elements there, is that he's good company for 350, 400 pages. I enjoy his company, and I hope the people that read the books enjoy his company too.
We have 9 times 350 pages. Well, let's talk about the TV show for a minute.
Okay.
It's on the Arts and Entertainment Channel, A&E, mm-hmm. and it stars Robert Taylor, who some people might remember as Agent Jones in
yes.
The Matrix. I didn't make that connection right away, and I love the Matrix movies. Lou Diamond Phillips plays Henry Standing Bear, mm-hmm. which was a surprise to me, maybe to you too, because I'd pictured Henry as much bigger.
Right. In the books, you know, Henry's like about 6'4". And it was interesting because, you know, whenever they came forward with Lou Diamond Phillips, I made the mistake that a lot of people do. Lou is not that small. Like, Lou's actually about 6 foot even, about, you know, a little over 200 pounds. Like, so he's actually a pretty good-sized guy. The difficulty is that Robert Taylor, the one that plays Walt, is a moose. Like, he's 6'4", like that, and wears a size 8 cowboy hat. you know, I mean, I'm like a 7 1/4, and I think I've got a big head. Like, I mean, when I first met Robert Taylor, I was like, my gosh, I hope you've got some big thoughts to bounce around in that pale of a head of yours. Like, but yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, and it's always interesting to see, you know, the reality of your characters, you know, come to life. You know, people ask, they say, well, what's it like? And I always say, well, it's kind of like having a house plant in your house, you know, for 7 years, and then all of a sudden getting up one morning and having it start talking to you. You know, suddenly you're confronted with these people that are delivering lines, you know, from the novels. And, you know, it's interesting that way, like that, to see, you know, the ways that they decided to go. One of the big issues, of course, like that, was Walt. I mean, that was, you know, one of the key elements rather in the casting of the show. And if they could find a Walt, that would be great. If they couldn't find a Walt, then they couldn't do the show. And they had a couple of different ways they could go. They could either go with somebody who was a big name that would draw an audience to the show, or they could go with someone who was a relative unknown. And I was kind of rooting for, you know, the relative unknown guy, you know, because, you know, as well as I do, that, you know, you have these characters in the last 20 years. If the character wears a cowboy hat, there are about a half a dozen guys that end up with that role and end up playing it. And they're all wonderful performers, but they've kind of, you know, done it a lot. And so you don't really look at them as the character anymore. You look at them as this conglomeration of characters instead. And so I was kind of rooting for the unknown guy like that. And they actually sent me the DVDs, you know, for the auditions, you know, for the characters, Warner did. And so I'm sitting there in my ranch with my wife, you know, and I'm putting the DVD in. And I get to the last one, and it's Robert Taylor, and I put it in, and I'm just watching him, and I'm thinking, you know, a couple of different things about him. First of all, you know, he just moved like a Westerner. You know, a lot of the actors, they moved like they were from L.A. or New York. Like, he just, the way he sat on the edge of the desk, the way he gestured, you know, the way inclined his head as he's speaking to this woman, I thought, you know, that was pretty wonderful. Like, and then the other thing was he had some age on him. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, anybody that plays Walt has to be of a certain age. And he had lines in his face. You know, he looked like a guy who'd been out and, you know, in the weather and seen a lot. And that very, you know, appealed to me a great deal. And the other thing, in the audition, he actually is doing a death notification. He's telling this woman that her husband is not coming home, and he's never met the woman before. He's never been in her home before. And he did something that none of the other actors did. He took his hat off. And I was like, well, we don't have to teach him basic civility. He actually already knows it. His mother did a good job. And so I just was very, very taken, you know, with Robert Taylor. I think he does an absolutely magnificent job.
As you said, he is the right age, and it shows when he tries to run after somebody.
Yeah, he's not an Olympic hurdler. Like, you know, generally, if Walt has to run after a suspect, generally the deputies can run faster than he can. So,
yeah, the other night when he was running after somebody, Walt was just kind of
yeah, that's tough.
Doing
difficult.
What he could, but not making much progress.
It takes it out of you doing that stuff. Like, you know, and some of us are built for fight rather than flight, you know. So speaking for myself, you know, I think I'm much better at, like, you know, just standing my ground rather than chasing after people. You know, we were the highest rated, and still are, the highest rated scripted drama in A&E's network history, which is not bad for a police procedural that takes place in the least populated county in the least populated state in America.
Not yeah. bad. So are we going to have Walt Longmire number 10 coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm an indentured servant to Viking Penguin Publishing, Warner Brothers, and A&E. Like, but you know what? It's, you know, people always ask, they always say, well, do you think you'll get bored and you know, and get tired of writing Walt like that? And I don't think I will. I mean, there are two elements here. One is, like I said, you know, I like riding along with Walt. I like going along with him, and he's a good guy like that, and I enjoy, you know, his company. And the other is, you know, that each one of the books is based off of some sort of a social problem. And my goodness, I could write about social problems until I was 120 and never scratched the surface. So
without being preachy, you do it.
Thank Another you very much.
Great thing about the books. Well, I'll look forward to the next one and look forward to seeing some more TV shows. I like them.
Thank you, dear.
Thanks for coming in.
You bet. My pleasure.
Craig Johnson lives near U-Cross, Wyoming. There's more about him, his books, and Longmire, the TV show, at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a week full of great reading and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.